My name is Shehzad Akbar. I'm a British qualified barrister. Right now, I'm working as a human rights lawyer in the UK. Formerly, I was in Pakistan and working as a human rights lawyer. And in between, I joined politics and I was a cabinet member of Mr. Imran Khan's cabinet as Federal Minister for Interior, which equates to Home Affairs in the UK, and accountability being his anti-corruption focal person or main person. And in 2022, when there was a regime change in Pakistan, and which was a military-led regime change, and I had to leave the country in fear of my life and safety. And that's when I came to the UK in 2022, and since then I've been here. But I would just like to make one point very clear that I'm not on an asylum, but I'm working here in the UK.
Oh, right. Okay. So maybe we could go right back to when you were a lawyer, before you entered politics. Can you just tell us how you got into that and what sort of cases you were covering?
Well, I started my legal profession in Pakistan by being a state prosecutor. I worked for some time in National Accountability Bureau, working on white collar crime, and that's my background of anti-corruption. But then once I left that job, I joined private politics, and then I started working on human rights. I worked extensively on the US war on terror related human rights violations in the region, covering Afghanistan, Pakistan. I have defended a number of civilian victims of drone strikes in Pakistan, and that led a successful campaign which brought cessation of drone strikes in Pakistan finally in 2017 and 18, just before I joined Imran Khan's politics. Along with, I have a long career working on death penalty cases, opposing the death penalty. Pakistan is one of the bigger countries having a large number of people on death row. I worked alongside British human rights organizations such as Reprieve, and been working and representing British nationals on death row in Pakistan as well for over 10 to 12 years. So that's my background in legal profession in Pakistan.
I think the drone strikes particularly are an aspect of warfare which is, it seems, is not going away. Can you just explain what the United States was doing? Because I think many people find it shocking and horrifying. We also hear about this concept of the double tap, the treble tap, etc., where there is an attack. And then, as the family, medical people turn up, there's an other attacks and successive attacks, and also the targeting of these mass family events like funerals and weddings.
Yes, that's very unfortunate, Tony, because drone strikes in Pakistan, I mean, drones to begin with, it's a weapon like any weapon, but it's a very dangerous weapon because it makes the political bosses sitting in the West taking the decision of use of this weapon very lightly, because first thing is that it doesn't have any risk attached to the person who is carrying out the attack. So it's use of force with almost zero risk to the person actually carrying out, versus if you are boots on ground, you're putting your own soldiers at risk. So they will, it's a completely different phenomena. But what was particular about Pakistani drone strikes was that this was an operation which was not done by US military, but this was an operation being carried out by CIA. And this is probably the only example in world history where a secret clandestine spying agency is actually committing or carrying out warfare and committing to some extent war crimes like the strikes that you mentioned. Now we see that taking place in Gaza as well. We saw that in Iran. It was alleged by Iran that there was a double tap strike. But this all started back in Pakistan because we actually documented a number of particular strikes which were actually quite troubling, because the double type strikes, which should amount to war crimes, honestly, because It's the rescuers. So what would happen is that the CIA will target a location which they suspect to be a militant location. Either it's a hideout or he's, some suspected militant at some place. And the irony of all of it was that this was all suspicion, right? There's no evidence, there is no confirmation, just a whim or some intelligence. I mean, it could be a very faulty intelligence, but they would act on it and they will strike one place. Now, their assumption was that as it is related or associated to a militant, the people who will come to rescue them would be militants too. And that's the logic behind double tap strikes. Whereas in reality, on ground, what happened was these were populated areas. So if there is a missile strike at one house or a school or a, mosque, people will come to clear the debris, take the injured out or dead out. There will be rescue, services. Either it's a government rescue or, communities rescue. There will be, even children, because I mean it's a dense population, and that's when the second strike will take place, with the assumption and actually expectation that they will kill some more bad people without having any specific target in mind. So this was one was double strike, but also funerals were targeted where it was suspected that some militant target will be attending, and this was all. It was all so whimsical and broad ranging, which also gave the indication that human life in this whole theater of war did not matter. And that's what we documented, that's what we collected. And what we collected was an overwhelming number of civilians that were killed in the name of a weapon which is being sold even today as a very precise and, perfect weapon. But that weapon is as perfect and precise, as the intelligence is. And we have seen this number of times that the intelligence is not as correct as it is believed to be or made us believe to be. So I think
Well,
that's the whole drone story.
yeah, well, look, it's not just that, is it, though? Because there is a cowardly aspect to all of this, in that the perpetrators of the death want to hide away. So I wonder, did you find out anything about who is controlling these, and where from?
Yeah, I mean, yes, that's the other thing, because there is a zero accountability of CIA which was carrying out, and I mean now it is almost public record that how the drone strikes decisions were carried out. I mean there was CIA station chief in Islamabad, and then the US ambassador in Islamabad. They will sit together and they will basically decide, okay, this is a good target or a bad target. And then we heard about this Terror Tuesday, where President Obama, actually, out of all people, would get to approve a kill list. I mean, the US actually had a kill list, and the people who actually were on that kill list, I mean, we don't know who these people were, what exactly they have committed. And they never bothered to tell us anything or even tell the American public or the Congress or any oversight committee. So in, I think, about 400 plus strikes just inside Pakistan during those years, more than 5,000 people were killed. And the question still remains today that what did US achieve in Afghanistan? Is the world a safer place? Are the American interests saved from all that killing? The answer is absolutely no. So I think that's where we are today.
Okay, so what about your introduction to politics? That's also, I think, an important aspect of what you've been doing, is actually being able to translate this knowledge of what foreign powers are up to in Pakistan into political action.
I think my introduction to politics was with basically Imran Khan, because while we were campaigning against drones and actually raising the issue of accountability, we were the only NGO in Pakistan or group of lawyers who were actually working on this and challenging US war on terror. And the specifically the human rights abuses and violations attached to it. And Imran Khan happened to be the only politician at that time who was in an opposition. It was relatively a smaller party. But he was from day one questioning the logic and legality of US war on terror in Afghanistan, which now, I mean, almost the whole world agree that it was a disaster to begin with. And US, despite spending trillion of dollars, has actually achieved nothing. So it was so that was the the background, and also my own personal experience of working on anti-corruption as a prosecutor in the past. So that's when I was actually invited by Imran Khan to join his party and politics. And once he was elected, he offered me a position in the cabinet. And this is how, because accountability for me has been a a lifelong mission, be it accountability of political office or political figures, people who have absolute power, or in the context of international relations or the war. So I think it was all in that context that I was given this portfolio, and I accepted it because Imran Khan's whole political struggle has been about accountability of the powerful and the rich, and trying to get Pakistan in the right direction. And that's how our work began. But I have to say it didn't end well.
Well, no, but in the meantime, how long were you in office and what did you achieve whilst you were there?
Well, I was in office almost whole tenure of Imran Khan's government. He came into power in August of 2022, sorry, 2018, and I was in office from August 2018 till January 2022. And just I resigned in 2022, and I think right after my resignation, there was a regime change and his government fell as well. In terms of achievement, Tony, it's a very long discussion, because by being in power, we were actually made to understand that corruption of politician is one thing, but there is institutional corruption, and then there is also the most powerful institution, which is Pakistani military, and their corruption is institutional plus individual. And they actually use the corruption of politicians to manipulate their own role in Pakistani politics and power politics. They do not actually like someone who is, squeaky clean like Imran Khan, because then the Pakistani military thinks they cannot really, blackmail them or, get them to accept the way Pakistani politics works, where the military, be them in power directly or not, they're able to control the real power. So I think that was the main struggle. So that was the biggest obstacle in terms of succeeding on a lot of corruption cases and recovery of money. But despite that, during those 3 years, we were able to strengthen or strengthening the institutions which are to work on these issues. I think we were the only government which actually did a lot of public accountability, where we challenged the rich and powerful. We had huge scams in those 3.5 years, where, for example, big mafias like something called Sugar Mafia, they were challenged. We did a public inquiry, and we became the only government which actually not only conducted public inquiries of a lot of government spendings and also corruption in different segments of society, but also made all that public. So there was access to information. Every commission that was made to, find out, be it the oil crisis or sugar crisis or wheat crisis, all those reports were made public, and people who were responsible were exposed. And today, all those peoples are in power, and Imran Khan is in prison, and I'm in exile.
Well, yes, it must be pretty frustrating, but I would suggest but maybe Pakistan is not the only country that's been run by that like that. But I know for anyone that doesn't know much about Pakistan's history, it has had a very dominant military over the decades. And I wonder, was there anyone within the military that actually felt like you did, that they wanted to root out this corruption, and that it was actually, sort of eating into the heart of the country?
Tony, I think this is what we often are made to believe, that the generals in military, they are relatively cleaner people. They actually want what we, what politicians like Imran Khan want from the from country, and they want to root out corruption. But I think our own personal experience proved that it was not true, because when Imran Khan came into power, there was very good relationship with the army chief, General Bajwa then, who gave the impression that he is also against corruption, and this is why he doesn't like Sharifs and Bhuttos. And but we saw from our own personal experience that that all was just to get the Sharifs and Bhuttos, which is Zardaris now, to agree to his terms. And once they agreed, he was very quick to dump Imran Khan's government and go for regime change. And I think this is what we have seen in the past as well, because if you look at all the military dictators in Pakistan's history, we've had like three dictators, and the current one is the fourth generation of dictators. The first three each had a tenure of 10 years of rule, and that was a direct rule. And now the new hybrid system, where you have the field marshal, and he has his handpicked prime minister, handpicked parliament, handpicked courts, and he's a dictator who is sitting in the background without any accountability. The three earlier generations of dictators, they all came on the mantra or the slogan of anti-corruption, and they want to root out corruption. And then we saw that within few years, they actually get the same politicians back into the play, just after making them agree to their rule, and that's how they live happily ever after. And this is what we're seeing right now. The man who is the field marshal now, and the man who is the prime minister and the president, when this man was the director general of military intelligence, he is the one who was actually investigating, and his agency was investigating their corruption. And then under his command, the military intelligence submitted a lot of evidence in various commissions formed by the Supreme Court then, back in 2017 and 18. Then we see the turn of events, and in 2022, the man is made the chief of army staff, and then, of course, everyone who he or his organization investigated in the past became kosher, because they all, sang "Hail Field Marshal," and then the field marshal is now ruling.
Now, look, you mentioned that you resigned before the regime change. Did you have some inkling that things were not going very well, or was that not connected?
No, it was very much collected, only because the regime change operation, and it is also now very well documented, started in play in 2021, somewhere around July. Because of my portfolio of Interior Ministry and being in the Prime Minister's office, I had access to a lot of intelligence and also information coming in. And we were quite aware that what the army is up to, and General Bajwa is up to, and how this thing is working. And of course, I, being the person who was the focal person for all law enforcement agencies working on corruption cases. Back then, the current Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif was under money laundering charges in two distinct cases, where actually his family had been involved in money laundering, including charges of money laundering from the UK and Middle East and other countries. So I was a big obstacle, and I could feel that I was one of the person who was being targeted by the ISI, which is the military, which is the intelligence of Pakistani military, and General Bajwa as well. So I think that was the reason for me to actually resign, because I felt that I'm becoming one bone of contention between the Prime Minister and the Chief of Army Staff. And it was simply becoming unbearing because one man cannot fight the institution. And there was a great personal risk attached to it. And therefore, I decided to resign, and Prime Minister accepted. And his government didn't last long afterwards.
Well, maybe you could tell us a bit about how that pressure was put on you. I think most people, when they elect politicians, hope that they're going to be able to do their job, particularly when it's anti-corruption. So, how did they pressurize you?
Tony, not different than what they're doing right now. In my time in UK in last 4 years, I've had about more than five direct attacks on me and my family. Once I left Pakistan, my family members were abducted and tortured. And while I was in office, I was given and I was sent. I mean, initially they will try to entice you to come to their terms, and if you refuse, then the threats come. And then you will also see the obstacles that are being created in the office, that you have information that the military is actually approaching the courts and judges and prosecutors to influence the outcome of various cases, investigations that are going. And I have been reporting all that to the Prime Minister as well. And when the Prime Minister will question the head of military, and that happened in my presence a few times, the military did not like it, and then the threats started coming in, and that's the time when I, realized that this is a time for me to leave and resign, because I think, and I was right in doing so, because even the Prime Minister could not stop them, and it was just 1.5 or 2 months later that his government was changed through a very dodgy regime change operation, which is now documented to be done at behest of American support as well.
For people looking at Pakistan, it's just another British colony where there's been problems. I wonder, do you think that after the Second World War, when we had independence for many of the colonies, that the problems that are now manifesting and have been over the decades in Pakistan were started there? Do you think the independence that Pakistan got was tainted?
It's Tony. It's again another very long drawn subject, and I think we might not be able to come to a conclusion within short span of our discussion. But yes, I mean, there are theories about it, that how the creation of Pakistan was, or division of the whole India, was also some of British conspiracy. But I don't go into those. I think the issue is that from the time of independence in Pakistan, that was also the time of Cold War. And during that Cold War, when Pakistan made a move of joining the Western bloc, unlike India, which remained non-aligned, that set the tone. And if you look at history of Pakistan in last 70 to 80 years, Pakistan and US had best of relations during the military regimes. So whenever the military was dealing in Pakistan, Pakistan had very cordial relations with Pakistan during the Cold War era of Field Marshal Ayub Khan in the 60s, or be it the 80s, late 70s, the Afghan War, and the cooperation of Pakistan and the US, and then lately post 9/11 during the era of General Pervez Musharraf. So all these times, Pakistani military, by this cooperation and patronage of US, actually gained more space in eliminating any democratic values, or actually the any grounds for democracy in Pakistan. You would see historical records showing how the socialist or communist movements or parties or student unions were crushed by General Ayub Khan or Field Marshal Ayub Khan, and that all had patronage of the US, because of course we were in the Western bloc then, right? And during the Cold War, any socialist thought was criminal. And then we saw the during the Afghan war era, the again crushing of any opposition, banning of political parties, General Ziaul Haq having a parliament which is not on political parties basis. It's a non-political parliament. It's basically individuals handpicked by a military dictator. And then even in Musharraf's time, and again now we see the party of Imran Khan being banned from contesting elections and all that. So there's a theme behind it, that how an institution, and by the way, this institution, this the institution of Pakistan Army, this was the legacy of the empire. It's all Sandhurst trained, and the mindset of same. I think when the British left Pakistan and India, somehow they left the same empire mindset to the Pakistani army, and India had been able to transform its army, but Pakistan unfortunately kept the same mindset in its military, constantly being trained at Sandhurst. Our cadets still come to Sandhurst, get trained, and they become general one day. The mindset is same. They treat rest of the country as their colony, and the empire now sits in the GHQ of Rawalpindi.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, thank you for condensing 70 years of history into a couple of minutes. Very good. But look, let's look at the regime change now. Can you give us your view of what happened and why in a nutshell?
Well, regime change was because Imran Khan's mission of anti-corruption and cleaning Pakistan's politics of corrupt politicians or the institutions, I think, was a hurdle in the grander schemes of things of the military and the army chief of then. And I think that's when he decided to get rid of him. Of course, now, if we look at some of the documents that have been revealed in last couple of years, including drop site publishing the cipher document, where we have evidence of the US State Department actually sanctioning the regime change in Pakistan, because they were made to believe by Pakistan's own army chief against his own prime minister Imran Khan that Imran Khan has an open mind or an independent mind, and he does not like to follow what Pakistan's foreign policy has been under military and more aligned to US, because Imran Khan actually dares to explore new international partnerships. Because Imran Khan's point of view was very simple. He will do whatever is in best interest of his people. He wants to get rid of corruption and poverty in Pakistan. So therefore, if he has to buy oil, for example, or energy from Russia, he will do that, because half of Europe buys its power and energy from Russia, or India, our own neighbor, does that as well. So why can't Pakistan do that? But these things were interpreted to the US as Imran Khan being some sort of fanatic, and that's how the US was actually embroiled into this conspiracy, and political opposition parties were. Now, actually, for example, the current defense minister of Pakistan, Khwaja Asif, is on record to say that it was General Bajwa, the army chief then in 2022, who got all the political parties, all the opposition parties together to bring a vote of no confidence in Imran Khan's party, and actually also made over 25 people from Imran Khan's party and his allies to defect, and this is how the regime change was brought in. And this would have been one of the many regime changes that have been done in past by patronage of Pakistan Army and the Americans. The only difference here is that Imran Khan exposed them. So once he was removed from the position of power, he actually felt relieved, I think, and he came out in open, and he pleaded his case with the people of Pakistan, and he exposed everyone involved, including the US and General Bajwa, and people responded. And he became even more popular than he ever was in Pakistani politics. And this is something that the army could not bear. There are multiple attempts on his life, including one where he was shot with 5 bullets, but he was saved miraculously. But the irony is that he, despite him being former prime minister, named people who must be investigated, and their names were not even included in the indictment again, on all this. But when I think the powers realized that they cannot stop his popularity, eventually they put him in jail. Imran Khan, who actually never even had a traffic offense, committed in his life, till the age of almost 70, all of a sudden we saw more than 200 cases registered against him, including a case of false marriage. So, I mean, you can imagine what, to what extent the establishment went to punish Imran. And even when he was in prison, the first year of prison, every court hearing, he will get a platform to speak, and his message will reach out to public, and that will increase his, popularity even more. So then establishment decided to put him in isolation, cut him off, and this is where we are today, where Imran Khan is in isolation, in solitary confinement for last over 6 months. He's not allowed to meet anyone. He's not been able to meet his family members for last 6 months. He's not been able to even meet his personal doctors in last 6 months. In last 6 months, he actually has lost one of his eye. He cannot see from his eye. It is now, it's a fact now. And same thing is happening to his wife, who has nothing to do with politics, but she is still also locked up. And she is undergoing the same treatment. Tony, there's law in Pakistan that a woman, no matter how what the charges are against her, cannot be kept more than 1 year without bail. I mean, bail becomes as a right after a year of pendency of cases, if, for example, conviction is not achieved, a final conviction from Supreme Court. But they have violated that as well. I mean, it's been 1.5, close to 2 years that she's in prison, and she's not being given the opportunity of bail. What they do right now is they don't even fix their cases for hearing in court. And it's, absolute violation of their rights. The UN Human Rights Council has already declared his arrest and detention arbitrary, and his conditions torturous. But Pakistan does not care, because right now we are the most favorite people of President Trump.
So what about Imran Khan's political support? Because I can remember when Trump was being prosecuted, his ratings also went up. Obviously, he managed to win in his cases, and he's now president. So what's the political support like for Imran Khan now, and how is it manifesting itself in Pakistan?
I mean, Tony, his political support level is such that he actually has never had that much support what he has now. It's for two reasons. I think one is that he has very successfully exposed the institution of army, and so I mean, there are people who are very pro Imran, and then there are people who don't like the army and institution, and that's why they're pro Imran. So that makes almost 90% people of Pakistan, or maybe even more. And that is the reason that he's being kept in prison. But one other fundamental thing that I missed actually in my narration of this, what's going on in Pakistan, is that the military, to actually successfully lock Imran up, actually brought in two constitutional amendments which eradicated any concept of judicial independence. There is no judicial oversight, there's no judicial independence. Any judge opposing this military rule has been thrown out of his position, or they are still in process of being thrown out. But above all, they have taken all the powers of judicial review from the Supreme Court. They created a new court. They call it Constitutional Court, but I actually call it an army court, where hand-picked judges by the government, which is the military basically, have been appointed there, and they have not heard even a single case of judicial review since their inception. And that's how they achieved locking Imran Khan up, and it's not just Imran Khan. They actually have prosecuted, which is actually persecution because prosecution has to be in open court. Under military courts, they have prosecuted over 100 politicians, including nephew, a young political student leader, nephew of Imran Khan, and who is who got educated in the UK. He's a lawyer like myself, and he is now undergoing 15 years imprisonment for what? For protesting outside a general's house. That's his offense. And that's also an alleged offense. We believe it's not even proven, but even if it's true, protesting outside a general's house gets you 15 years imprisonment through a military court. That's the state of affair, and this is how they have been crush any sort of dissent. But despite all that, Imran Khan is, popular as ever.
And probably gaining popularity, even if that's possible. Look, this all sounds very medieval, but I have to ask you, I mean, if you had remained in Pakistan, you may be in jail now. So how did you come to the UK?
Well, if I was in Pakistan, I would be actually in worse conditions than him, actually, because probably I'm not as popular as Imran Khan that people will care and come outside prison every week to protest. The government was changed on 10th of April, or yeah, 10th or 11th of April. My name was put on a no-fly list by the incoming government. Actually, the name was put even before the incoming government, but thankfully there was some independent judiciary. So very next morning, I went to Islamabad High Court and challenged, stop my name being on the stop list. It went back and forth in court, and then within 6 or 7 days, I was able to get my name deleted from the list because, of course, there was nothing against me, and there was no legal basis or foundation for putting me on a no-fly list, which, anyways, is a black law. The moment my name was taken out, and I knew they will actually go for putting it on again, there was a very short window, and I just left the country. And I consider Britain my second home because I lived here before. Here I worked here before. I got my all university education, my earlier experience in the UK. That's where I met my wife, and so this is how I came about here. And I actually, when I came, Tony, I mean, this was the idea was not to actually live here. The idea was just to, let it cool down, and I wanted to just go back to, my own human rights work back in Pakistan. But as the time progressed, I realized that the situation is far worse than I anticipated because a few months after, my house in Pakistan was raided. And my brother was kidnapped. He was captured and used for ransom to actually extract some sort of a statement against Imran Khan. He was kept in military confinement for 100 days, in very worse conditions and tortured. So that's the time when actually my children also left the country, and then they joined me here. And since then, this has been home.
And I know that there is over the Christmas period there was your name was popping up in some of the news bulletins because of reports that the arm of the Pakistani military and the intelligence services had actually stretched over here. I mean, they've been doing it through the courts, but also I believe you were attacked.
Yes, this is not the first time in the UK, unfortunately, Tony, that I have been attacked. I came to this country thinking and believing this is a place with the rule of law and some system, and of course they cannot do anything illegal. They have been trying to, extradite me from UK or bring in any sorts of claims, and that's all welcome because because there's a judicial process, and I'm very happy to fight anything. They have actually also sought Interpol notices against me, which have very successfully fought, and Interpol deleted their request. So that's all fine, but when they did not succeed, the first attempt that was made on my life was in 2023 and not this year. It was November of 2023 when I was living back in Hertfordshire. On a Sunday evening, my door was knocked. I opened the door, and there was acid thrown on me. My, 5-year-old daughter was standing behind me. And it was a horrific experience, not just for me, but my family, my children. And then later on, we found out that there were actually two assailants who came to our house. Despite police investigation, they could not find who it was, and the case was, investigation was closed after a year. And this is 2023. And then 2025, I actually had informed the authorities that I'm getting new threats, and because of some new cases that are being brought against the Pakistani government in the US as part of my human rights work, there are new threats. And actually, myself and my colleague Clive Stafford Smith, we actually had written to the Home Secretary, who actually responded. And we were in contact with the police and the Scotland Yard regarding my security. But against our horror, on Christmas Eve, I was attacked at my home. There was an assailant who came, and he gave me some, nasty punches, and again entered my place and beat me up. That was 24th. That was the Christmas Eve morning, and that was the first incident. After that, we were moved away from our property. We were taken into police protection, and a week later, when we were cleared to go back to our property on the New Year Eve, I had the second attack on me at my house. And this time it was not, just a physical attack. This was arson, and also with weapon. Three bullets were fired at my place, inside my house, on my front door window. And then there were two assailants who tried to set house on fire. I was lucky to have escaped them by just 4 minutes, Tony. I was just able to leave 4 minutes before. Had I been there, that's the, I would have been their target. And unfortunately, that wasn't it. After that incident, there were three more attacks at my place. And we were not able to return to our home for months, and we remained in police custody for months. But thankfully, now some people have been arrested. It's still, as you know, it's a ongoing matter. It's an ongoing investigation. 15 or 16 arrests, I believe, have been made in this instance. The police or the prosecutor in this case, where 7 or 8 people were charged in London, called it a targeted attack on myself and another dissident, Adil Raja, because the first attack, although the other attacks might not be related, but the first attack on the morning of 24th, it was also a coordinated attack, because at around same time, two assailants also went to Adil Raja's house in another location. And he was lucky that he wasn't home, but his home was ransacked and damaged. And those people who came, they came with the intention to make him realize that he was paid a visit. Those people have also been arrested, and they are under trial as well. So this is the extent. I mean, I'm very clear about it, what it is. But I would believe that the British authorities and they will actually look into it. That who actually really is targeting me, because the prosecutor said it was a targeted attack. So I think it's an ongoing investigation, and I think we are under also a sort of an embargo to not talk too much till the trial is
Well,
over.
I mean, for people that don't know, when there's an ongoing case, I think we need to be really clear here, where charges have been laid, these are all just allegations about what's happened. But what one thing that does interest me is the sensitivity with which the Daily Telegraph have been talking about what sounds like similar attacks. It could be that they say that Iran may be hiring thugs to carry out anti-Semitic attacks. That's the fears of police. The sub-headline earlier this week was Islamist group has been linked to Tehran and it's claimed responsibility online for a series of attacks, the latest of which targeted a synagogue in Harrow. And so what the Telegraph and the Matt Dukes from the Counter-Terror Command in London in the southeast is saying here is that these are basically just organized crime. It looks as if someone, it's very difficult to trace who maybe, but it's not necessarily so difficult when you look at the political context. It's just simply paying organized crime thugs to go around and carry out attacks. Now, this may not apply to you, but it certainly seems that the police are saying it may be applying to these attacks on synagogues, etc. So I wonder, is there any way to trace, do you think, potentially, who's been doing this?
I think that there is definitely a way to trace this, Tony. I mean, first of all, we have to understand and realize that transnational repression is a reality, and transnational repression happening in UK to dissidents from all countries who are, living here, it's a reality. The UK's Parliament Joint Human Rights Committee actually conducted an inquiry into it. I mean, their focus was more on China and Iran, but a large number of dissidents from Pakistan, from UAE, Saudi Arabia, India, and many other countries, they actually gave testimonies to a lot of predicament they are facing in the UK, where either the foreign despotic states, be them friendly state or a non-friendly state like Iran or China for that matter, are targeting their dissidents in the UK. And sometimes these targets actually take the form of physical violence against such people. And there are reports that such states actually then, rather than having their own agents carrying out such strike, hire organized crime because there are mentions of using dark web to hire and covering the tracks, or in some cases, people or some countries feel that nothing, no harm will come to them. They use their own embassies in the UK to engage in such activities. I mean, we have cases in, for example, Canada, where Canada actually went too far ahead in calling out the transnational repression from India against the Indian dissidents in Canada. And we have cases in the past where a man was hired from East London to go and stab or try to kill a Pakistani dissident in Holland. And that man was tried in the UK, Tony, and he was convicted. So there are, cases, multiple cases, where we have evidence of this transnational repression in the UK and also from friendly states. Now, the question is how the British government, and this is not, I'm not saying about police, because what we have seen in my own particular case is once the police puts their mind to it, with resources like the Scotland Yard, they can actually catch people very quickly. But it's the political side, the political side, it's their decision eventually, because it's the political softness that enables countries, many countries, I'm not just naming one country, but many countries like Pakistan to do, whatever they like to do, and they go, unpunished. So I think that's, that's the main question here, that if UK would like the UK to be a place which is placed under a rule of law and due process, and they do not let any other foreign state, be it a friendly state or non-friendly state, to take law into their own hand, because if for example UK is allowing that, then a lot of countries will settle their scores in the UK through organized crime, and it's very simple and very easy and somehow cheap as well to get it done.
Well, let's hope that through your case justice is done, and that it may be not so cheap in the years to come and in the future, and it sets a good precedent. We shall see. Look, I also have to ask you about another side of all of this, which is the spiritual side, which journalists dare very rarely talk about, which is the spectre of a country like the United States having such domination in the world. In fact, we've seen it in the UK as well, where Keir Starmer at the beginning of the Iran war says to the United States, no, you can't use bases in Britain. And now we find that a base in Gloucestershire is being used during the war daily to send bombers over. It's almost as if the Americans don't care whether the British say. The same in many countries around the world dominated by the United States. So I wonder if you think there is a sort of spiritual side to this, a bigger fight, a bigger battle. Obviously, Pakistan is generally a Muslim country, an Islamic country. Iran is an Islamic country. The Russians see themselves as an Orthodox Christian country. And so I wonder if you think there is this sort of spiritual battle playing out here.
Tony, I'm not a very spiritual person, and I don't think that it's a spiritual battle or of any sort of that thing going on. It's actually a battle of power and money. US has the power, US has the money, US controls the money, therefore US thinks that it can actually get away with whatever they like. And of course they can, because I think the whole idea of Britain having the US sites in the UK, or for example, many Western European countries. It's the fear of Russia. It's the fear of unknown enemy, and the sort of protection, and also then financial dependence on the US. But however, this recent war or conflict in Iran has exposed that fallacy to a great extent. I mean, there's one view of how Trump is behaving and how he is exposing all this fallacy, rather too quickly. But also you have to see that, Gulf states, which are paying way more than actually Britain is, for example, to the US for their own protection, but they saw and they experienced when this during this conflict they were not able to defend themselves as they would have liked to, from all the money they have paid. So now a lot of countries are looking, either inwardly or elsewhere. And I think the way US has behaved in current scenario will give a lot of thoughts to European leaders, including France, Germany, and United Kingdom, to think about the NATO and also over dependence on US to be their protector. And I think it's a new discussion now for the political thinkers. And also this might become an issue in upcoming elections everywhere in the world. So I think this Iran war has generally exposed a lot of things. As far as the question of spirituality side and the Iran being a Muslim country and Pakistan being a Muslim country, I think the issue is far more complex than that, because Pakistan has recently signed or renewed its defense pact with Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia, for example, feels threatened from Iran. And although Pakistan is now negotiating and trying to, reach to a conclusion between US and Iran and avoiding the war, but let's suppose if there is war and they don't succeed, Pakistan has clearly taken a side by signing up a defense deal with the Saudi Arabia, and of course not for free. Pakistan is now being supported by Saudi Arabia for up to $8 billion in immediate economic relief against this service. And right after signing this agreement, Pakistan sent its air force to be stationed in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia feels that the American presence in Saudi Arabia is actually not really helping them. So therefore they sought Pakistan's support. So I think in that context, I think it's a battle of money, influence, greed, power, rather than any religion basis. We do use religion to our own convenience, but I don't think that religion is the main reason behind all these conflicts.
What about nuclear weapons? Do you think they've turned out to be a curse for Pakistan, or do you think that there is a good and useful thing to have?
I think the issue is, I mean, the dynamics of Pakistan and India are such that Pakistan has to do everything that India does, or India has to do that everything Pakistan does. So therefore, once India had tested its nuclear weapon, Pakistan basically had no choice but to test the nuclear weapon and actually have the nuclear weapon. So the nuclear weapon of Pakistan is in context of India. But it came with a great price because the economy of Pakistan changed after having nuclear because it's a very expensive product to have. But I'm not an expert of nuclear weapons and should they be or not. But I think in terms of strategic relevance of Pakistan, it does create a relevance because whenever there's a conflict between India and Pakistan, it becomes problem of the whole world because these are two nations with nuclear weapons. So that's why I think the issues or the war between India and Pakistan does not escalate to a level where it there's more destruction because there is the threat or fear of the nuclear weapons as well. So yeah, there are arguments against and for nuclear weapons, but I think in terms of strategic benefit, Pakistan did get strategic benefits for having nuclear, but at the same time, the cost was too much. I mean, I think there's more poverty in Pakistan and to some extent in India as well after going nuclear.
Yeah, interesting. And I think, for many people, they don't know this history. Thank you for that. That it was actually initiated by India. And, if you've got a major rival, of course, this is going to impel you to consider developing nuclear weapons. It's amazing in some ways that the Iranians have chosen not to in the Middle East. But anyway, look, finally, I'd like to just hear from you your thoughts about solutions in Pakistan. I mean, you've been there when the country's been functioning rationally, normally, with at least an attempt at creating a permanent rule of law where the people are served by their government rather than serving the government. So what are your thoughts about solutions there?
Tony, I think the solution is very simple, and we talk about it often, but I don't think we really we put it to motion. The solution is actually continuance of democracy. See, democracy is not probably the best system, but it is the only system that we have. So we preach democracy. A lot of Western countries preach democracy, but unfortunately, in reality, they support aristocracy or dictatorship in countries like Pakistan just for their own convenience. I think we need to believe in what we see and what we say and what we practice. Pakistan has to go in a complete democratic rule. It might not be ideal to begin with, it will have its own issues, but continuity is the key. And the West has to, including the US and UK, stop pandering our dictators. I would not like to see Field Marshal Asim Munir coming to Sandhurst and speaking on behalf of King, as I saw General Bajwa coming to Sandhurst and representing your queen. I think that's what sends really bad messages. These people, they are the they are the people who are behind. These are the figures who are behind working against democracy and democratic values and rule of law in countries like Pakistan. So if, for example, we believe in the values that we talk about, then we should simply, our foreign policy should be, working on that. We cannot, for example, I mean, it's, UK is at forefront of criticizing China, but again, in terms of trade, UK is one of the larger, China's trade partner as well. So I think we have to, start practicing our preaching as well.
Okay, whereabouts can listeners find and follow you and follow your case?
Well, first of all, I mean, I do a lot of media myself, but I think my Twitter feed, which is Shehzad Akbar, so Shahzadakbar, so they can follow me there or on my YouTube channel. Unfortunately, that's in Urdu because my audience is largely Pakistani or Indian, but people who understand the language can follow me there.
Okay, Shehzad Akbar, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Toby.